This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.
Please, speak as you might to a young child or a golden retriever.
It's an unfair game.
They're schemers. Schemers trying to control their little worlds.
Rich get richer, that's the law of the land.
It's just money.
Blasphemy! This is madness!
I drink your milkshake!
Hey everybody, welcome back to Milkshakes, Markets, Madness. My name is John Kutzmita. I'm joined here with Brent Johnson. Please visit milkshakespod.com if either of us are unfamiliar to you, if you don't know what the dollar milkshake theory is, and this is the first time coming here. We're going to talk about markets. We're going to talk about the madness of financial markets. And a big part of that is the US dollar's role in the monetary system, which is what the dollar milkshake theory is all about. We're not going to bore our regular listeners and viewers with that here. Instead, we're going to jump right into some of the things that are going on. In particular, Brent Johnson, you just got back from quite an eventful trip, or I hope it was eventful.
Yeah, it was great. I was in Europe for 2 weeks. The first week was kind of a combination vacation and work, and then the second week was all work, but it was pretty fun. So doesn't suck going to Europe for a couple of weeks.
Now, you kind of mixed in business with pleasure. But let's focus on the business part. I know you can't share inside baseball, but was there any kind of, maybe just from your experience, I know you had an interesting cab ride at one point. You met some people, some new friends, some old friends. Give us some behind the curtain stories.
Well, so one of the things I always do, no matter where I travel, especially when I'm outside the United States, is I just always ask the cab driver if they'll accept dollars. And 99 times out of 100, they do. Occasionally, they won't. The one place I remember them absolutely saying no was in London, and that was about 10 years ago. They're like, no, we're not taking dollars. So I think that probably goes all the way back to the Revolutionary War, but, you know, yeah. So c'est la vie. And then, you know, it's interesting. Several places this time, they took it. They took it in Madrid. They took it in Zurich. They didn't take it in Barcelona, interestingly. They're like, no, And a lot of times I'll still pay with a credit card, but I'm just curious. It's just one of these little things that I ask. And so that was pretty interesting. And, you know, I posted about it on Twitter. And of course, a lot of people are like, no, they didn't accept dollars. This is fake news. And you're lying. And, you know, why would I lie about a taxi driver taking dollars? But anyway.
So what are some of the other takeaways you had from your trip?
There was a couple of really interesting stuff. Well, the first thing I'll say is, so I went to a conference in Vancouver at the end of January, and it was a natural resource conference. So a lot of, gold miners, copper miners, you know, anything kind of resource related. And at the time, gold and silver and the miners were kind of, they'd had a very good January, and everybody was extremely bullish. Now, this time, what was interesting is subsequent to at the end of January, into February, a lot of those markets pulled back. You know, gold and silver pulled back. The miners pulled back a lot. But then, you know, they bottomed right around the time of the banking crisis in the U.S. And subsequent to that, they've rocketed back up to the highs. And so in Zurich, I was at a gold conference. And what was very interesting is, even though we were kind of back at the highs, everybody was very subdued and everybody was very, you know, skeptical, not believing the breakout, not believing that this time was for real. So I don't know if it was just a bunch of jaded gold investors who are getting tired of getting beat up, or if that's, but one of the, you know, one of my friends, Ronnie Stoferla, said, this is a bullish sign. If we're at the highs and people in the industry and the people are traditionally bullish about gold are bearish, then that's probably a good sign. And, you know, I kind of have to consider that. I think that gold is due for a pullback, and I think we'll probably pull back into the summer. But he's got a point. You know, if at some point gold and silver and the miners are going to just take off and they're not going to look back. And I kind of feel like maybe we've got another pullback in us, maybe into the summer. But I think for anybody who is somewhat interested in this space and doesn't have a position yet, it's probably time to start taking a fairly close look.
Brent, I got a couple questions around that. So we haven't really talked about gold much. We kind of fly by on it a little bit, partly because there hasn't really been much to talk about. I mean, you've highlighted at various times throughout our experience doing the show where miners have been, kind of where gold has ebbed and flowed. But this is a much bigger conversation lately, right? Where we'll call it resistance around the 2000 level. It's a conversation starter amongst many other things, because where, I guess the question or the thing I'm trying to circulate in my mind is, if the Fed, as you say, is not dumb, maybe a bit arrogant, they got to be looking at this. They can see that there's just this frothy animal spirit waiting for a Fed pivot. So higher rates produces, you know, solid yields. Why own the pet rock when you can get cash flow? At a certain point, the Fed turns on the money printer, QE, whatever you want to call it, however you want to look at it. And then you start to look for things that are considered more like hard money, whether it's your version of that is Bitcoin or gold. And both of those assets are kind of hovering at, you know, Bitcoin's up nearly 90% on the year. But look, prior to 2020, all-time highs were around 20,000. That's kind of formed a new level of support. Gold outside of, we'll call it, say, the 1100 and or 2000, 1900 and 2011, we've now kind of, it seems like, in that 1600-1700 range, found a channel. But does the Fed look at all this? Does the Fed look at this and say, okay, we're going to stop hiking, everyone's going to go into this, this means it's a pivot. Maybe they just go sideways and they just hold at this 500 basis point overnight lending rate for a really long time. And maybe shit doesn't break. And maybe they don't have to go to QE. And at what point, so I'm obviously just kind of setting up a narrative, but I'm trying to understand, you know, all sides of the story of what gold can do here.
Yeah, so I've been on record several times saying that I think before this is all said and done, gold's going to $5,000. But I've also said several times that I sold all my miners back in 2017, 2018, and I haven't bought them back since. That's 5 years ago now. And the reality is they are still lower than the level at which I sold them 5 years ago. So despite a number of runs along the way, they haven't really clearly broken out. I am of the belief that miners should be rented and not owned. I have a gold allocation for myself and for all my clients that I really, honestly, I don't even really think about it too much. It's just there. It's kind of an insurance policy. I think every portfolio should have it. With the miners, I think you've got to own them for short periods of time. And when they've had a good run, then you sell them. Now, part of the reason that I think that gold is going to have a pullback in the very short term is I think the Fed is going to stay tighter for longer than many people think. And I think that, I think we will get this pullback into the summer. And if the other reason that I've held off is because I think before the Fed pivots, I think what is going to cause the Fed to pivot is some kind of a risk-off event. And typically, when you have a risk-off event, and especially one significant enough to cause the Fed to have to pivot into QE or easy monetary policy, typically becomes some kind of a liquidity crisis. And if you look back through every liquidity crisis, during the crisis, gold and the miners get liquidated, along with everything else, because everybody's trying to grab dollars. And I can show you time and time and time again where this has happened. Now, what typically happens, though, is once you get through that event, gold and the miners often rebound quicker than everything else. And so that's it. And so my point is, now that, you know, we're kind of back at the highs here, everybody's still kind of bearish. I still think we're going to get one of these liquidating markets at some point. But I think you've got to be ready to buy at that point, because these things are not going to stay down forever. And when another, you know, surge of global liquidity comes, I would expect gold and silver and the miners to do very well. And now again, if you get into them and they go on a 50-60% run, I think you sell them and then try to buy it back on a dip. What's interesting, John, is I did this analysis at the beginning of the year, went back and looked at several different gold mining indices. And these are, doesn't mean you can't make a ton of money on them, but these are horrible businesses. These gold mining companies, most of them are just horrible, horrible businesses. And if you look at GDXJ, which is the junior miners as an index, it's about 10 or 12 years old. It's negative like 60% since inception. The GDX, which is the kind of the more the senior producers, the bigger gold mining companies, I think it's been around for almost 15 years, and it's down about 40% since inception. There's another mining index called the Philadelphia Gold and Silver Miners Index that goes back to, I think, 1984, so almost 40 years. And it's flat since inception. And the only reason it's, I think it's flat to up just a tiny bit, but that's only because of this big run we've seen in the last month. Other than that, it's basically flat since inception. So think about that. For 40 years, gold miners as a group haven't gone anywhere. But there's been several times along the way where you could make 20, 30, 40, 100%. And I think, you know, if you can time the liquidity cycles correctly, you can make some good money there. But I don't think these are things that you just buy and stick them away and forget about them.
Yeah, so the miners are more of a trader's play. Gold, in the examples that you're given where there's a big risk-off event and it sells off, I think this is one of the things that people need to keep in mind. That's exactly, in a lot of cases, why people have gold in their portfolio. It's a highly liquid asset, so when you need liquidity, it's one of the best things to sell. But at the same time, we're now in a new paradigm where we're so aware of what the policy response is going to be. Call it 2008 or maybe before, central banks have kind of, from a narrative standpoint, backed themselves into a corner. We know that they're going to come and rescue. They used to be able to dance around that story and pretend that isn't what they're, you know, what they're facilitating. We know they're not going to do that. So be prepared for that sell-off when people are trying to raise liquidity using, you know, the pristine liquid assets, but get ready for that rip higher when people start looking at the macro side of things and, hey, this is, you know, central banks are coming in to generate a ton of liquidity.
Yep. You know, on the flip side, you know, a lot of times people don't, people that are into gold don't like dollars, and people that like dollars aren't into gold. You know, I'm kind of the unique one in that I like both of them. But, you know, on the flip side of gold, I had a very interesting dollar conversation while I was there as well. One of my clients is a part of a very successful family from the Middle East who imports luxury goods from Switzerland and the rest of Europe into the Middle East. And, you know, they've been doing this for years, very successful. I was having lunch with him and one of his bankers is at a very, you know, prestigious, well-known private bank in Switzerland. And we were talking about, you know, what's gone on not just the last couple of years, but especially the last year with the Russian sanctions. And, you know, this banker not only works with, you know, my client, but he works with a number of, you know, royal families and, you know, some of the most successful families in the world. Like he's, you know, he works with the wealthiest people in the world. And we were some Russians. He works with some Russians, the truth be told. And so last year
I didn't want to sneak the R word in there, but
yeah. Well, so, and, you know, there's a lot of very wealthy, successful Russians who have wanted to get their money out of Russia, and, you know, natural place for them to have an account is in Switzerland. So, you know, when the edict came down last year from the U.S. that we are going to sanction, you know, Russia and certain Russian businesses, and Switzerland signed up for it, you know, the Russian accounts were immediately frozen, and, you know, there was nothing, and the rubles, you know, they had a bunch of dollars in the accounts, but they also have rubles in the accounts as well, and the rubles could not be sold. You know, you could theoretically go down to the bank and withdraw your physical rubles if they actually had them and take them out on the street with you, but nobody would trade them. So even though you had them, and even, no matter what the exchange rate said was going on your screen, nobody would trade the rubles in Switzerland. Nobody would do a crossing transaction to another currency. And so, the point that I make here is it's, the ruble can only be used in Russia, right? And to get it there, it's not easy. And part of the reason I say this is, you know, this idea that there's this new world out there that no longer needs the dollars and no longer needs Western institutions. Well, there's a lot of very successful people in Russia and China, in Iran, and some of these other that have an incredible amount of assets outside of those countries. And they value those assets very highly, even though they're not in yuan and even though they're not in Russian rubles. and they don't want to see their assets get confiscated. And they especially don't want to see their U.S. dollar assets get confiscated. And the rubles that they have, or the yuan that they have outside of their domestic economies, are mostly worthless. There's not a whole lot that they can do with them. And when I was asking him, you know, if he thought that this would affect business going forward, his point was that, you know, they just won't. This is a reason why people won't hold rubles or yuan, because at the end of the day, they want to be able to serve the Western citizens, right? If they have to choose between Western citizens and the Eastern citizens, they're going to choose the Western citizens. And if you think about the history of Switzerland and, you know, their neutrality throughout the wars, and, you know, they're a safe haven for capital from around the world, from all over the world for decades. And now recently, you know, with this latest sanctions from the last year, the fact that they signed up with Europe, with the EU and with the United States and many of the other countries around the world, it's really telling. And you know, the idea that sanctions don't have any effect, I think, is wrong. It doesn't mean that they work perfectly. It doesn't mean that we should just do them. It doesn't mean that they will automatically mean that the U.S. wins and Russia loses. But the idea that sanctions have no impact and don't affect those who are being sanctioned is just completely wrong. And so, you know, the fact that when they did sanction Russia and when they did put a freeze on these accounts, it had real world consequences. And, you know, those assets are still there and they're frozen and there's not much that can be done with them.
Good breakdown there. Play along with me here. I have some quick questions for you. How would you describe someone who's absolutely in love with gold? What's the name you would apply to that person?
A gold bug.
Okay. And similar type of personality, but loves Bitcoin.
Laser-eyed crazies. maybe a crypto bros or something.
I was pushing towards Bitcoin Maxi, but yeah.
Bitcoin Maxi. There you go.
Laser eyed crazies. That'll be one of your new hashtags. What about someone who's just super into their particular sports team?
Oh, they're just, you know, total fans, right? Fanboys or whatever you want to call them. Yeah.
So what's the label here that we would give to somebody that, and I don't think this really exists, but someone who's just has a love affair with the U.S. dollar?
Well, I've been called a CIA agent. I've been called, you know, a U.S. propagandist. I've been called a U.S. exceptionalist, a jingoist, a fiat maxi. Yeah, you can call me any of those things, I guess. I don't really care. But the reality is, I do not consider myself a U.S. dollar maxi. I think that the U.S. dollar is going to have some very bad days ahead of it. I just happen to think that before those really bad days show up, there's going to be some, you know, it's going to put on a show that, you know, perhaps will never be forgotten. And so, you know, there are a lot of problems with fiat currencies, a lot of problems. And, you know, the fact that it can be printed leads to abuse by those in charge of the printing, whether it's the politicians or the central bankers. And that always ends up having extremely negative consequences. And the U.S. will be no exception. We have many, many fiat sins to pay for, and we will pay for them. But it's not just the United States in this situation, right? The whole world uses fiat currency. And fiat currency will, you know, have its days where it works really well, and it's going to have its times where it works really poorly. And I think we're entering a period of time where, you know, fiat currencies will work really poorly, but one of them will work better than all the others. And I think that's the U.S. dollar.
Well, I already know that all those who are very much not fiat maxis and fall into any one of those other fanatical categories, or just have a different overall macro view where they disagree with your dollar bullishness, will most likely never watch that piece of this podcast episode and therefore be quick to jump to conclusions and make all kinds of fun comments in Twitter, on YouTube. I just think it's fun now that I'm kind of sucked into this black hole a little bit with you and kind of manage these accounts at various times. It's funny to me, we have no problem with the conversation and people having their own view and opinions. I think it's more just comical to me. It's the hyperbole or the ad hominem attack or just the fact that it's people. I think the like you're an idiot type of comment, like that type of tone, and then explaining why you're an idiot because dollars are worthless or whatever their argument is. I think it's really funny when people do that because they don't even see their own foot entering their mouth because they don't actually know the conversations that we're having and what the dollar milkshake theory is actually explaining and what you just kind of summarize as your overall view. So I'm glad that you put that out there so that nobody can hear it. So thank you for that.
Cool. Good stuff. What's going on with you, man? What's going on down in Australia? Let's turn this around a little bit.
It's starting to get a little chilly. I might be joining you back in the Caribbean islands here pretty soon, maybe in another month.
Okay.
Other than that, I'm just, you know, it's kind of hard to beat the lifestyle here in Sydney, at least. It's a beautiful city. It's got great people. It's very clean and safe, and the food's really good. The coffee is just, I mean, I think that's one of the things whenever I leave here, like I can't wait to come. It's like that first cup of coffee when I come back here. It sounds really silly, but I never drank coffee before I came here. And it really is kind of, I really like high quality scotch and Islay single malt scotches. And so I don't know if this is a similar type of appreciation, but you know, I've learned to really love high quality coffee and nothing against our friends in Puerto Rico. They grow some really good beans, but I don't know if they figured out how to actually make a decent cup of coffee yet.
Got it. All right. Well, when you get back, you can tell me all the stories you can't say publicly here.
Yeah. Well, that's what the tequila's for when we get back. Well, we'll have to tell that wild story one of these days of the last time we were hanging out and someone had
That's right. Yeah, we do need to tell that story. Yeah.
We will. On the next episode. Well, look, man, it's good to have you back. This is... You know, we had a very, very short hiatus with the travel schedule. This will be hopefully the first of two this week, and let's see what kind of unfolds. It's been a little quiet, but I think we touched on some of the things, the price action sideways. Maybe we'll have some fireworks by the end of the week. But otherwise, thanks for that recap from your trip. Everybody, please follow us at Milkshakes Pod on Twitter and on YouTube. You can follow Brent and I on Twitter as well. And if you're new to any of these conversations, please visit milkshakespod.com for more information and links and resources and all that good stuff. Until then, Brent, thanks so much, and we'll see everybody soon.
See everybody.